What is up, bosses? Before we start this week's episode, I want to tell you about our sponsor. It is Fundrise. Now, in 2021, a truly diversified portfolio needs more than just the traditional mix of stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. You need to be in private real estate, and that's where Fundrise comes in. In fact, Johnny, Sam, and myself have all personally invested in Fundrise even before they were a sponsor of Invest Like a Boss. So if you want to check out Fundrise for yourself, I'm going to tell you more during the break, but get a head start. Go to fundrise.com/likeaboss. That's FUNDRISE.com/likeaboss. Now, on to this week's episode.
Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
What's up, bosses? Episode 190 of Invest Like a Boss. My name is Derek Spartz. I'm back home in Venice Beach, and I'm joined with Sam Marks, who I believe is still in Barcelona.
Back in Barcelona, still in Barcelona. I think last time we chatted, Derek, we actually saw each other. It was in the Ukraine just a couple episodes back. So we are back home and back into the routine.
Yeah, it only took like 5 days to get rid of my jet lag, but I feel like I'm back in the routine here. And this episode that we're about to talk about actually came up while we were together in the Ukraine. I remember we were in that cool little coffee shop that was kind of in the basement. Mm-hmm. And this suggestion for this guest came through on Patreon. So shout out if you're a member of Patreon, you can actually suggest guests that will be on iLab. And I actually go out and look for them most of the time. So we got a pretty good batting average if you suggest a guest on Patreon and we're interested in it. We're going to get them on the show. So this came up for KRBN, the Crane Shares ETF about carbon dioxide and emissions. And I was like, this is perfect for Sam because Sam is all about this environmental kind of doing better for the environment and responsible investing. And I was like, Sam.
Thanks, Derek. Thanks for painting such a rosy picture of me. So actually, when I saw this episode come in, or when Derek set up the episode, I thought it was on the basis that we've talked a lot about sustainability and kind of impact investing. So I'm like, oh, Derek, very proactive of you just going up and finding, finding some of these investment opportunities. But actually it did come through the Patreon. So I was very pleased to see it. And when I saw this episode outline, I was like, this looks awesome from everything that we're talking about in terms of being able to profit, being a good investment for the world, you know, a good bet for the world, and just generally a good initiative that I know we're going to learn a lot about, because this is something it's now a conversation piece, right? Carbon emissions, of course, global warming, but really like carbon credits. You know, I think everyone's started to hear about carbon credits, but the fundamentals and how they actually work is still a little twisted. And it's a very new industry. So there's a lot of new lingo that's going to be explored in this episode. I'm interested in that, but I'm also interested in the profit narrative.
So this is something that I knew existed, and I guess I didn't even really know that you could profit off it. And obviously, you know, it makes sense that there's an incentive to get these companies out there to innovate and pollute less. I just didn't know how it worked. So I was actually really curious about this subject, and the fact that you can invest in it and profit off it at the same time while, you know, essentially doing something good for the environment. I think it's a win-win situation, and I'm really excited to hear what Luke has to tell us about how this all works.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk about one of the main terms of this episode. It's called cap and trade. I won't spoil it here, but we're going to talk about that in the episode. We're going to talk about how carbon credits work. And Derek, I'm sure you and a lot of the other listeners know, like, carbon credits has become a big thing with the names of Microsoft, who's basically saying they're going to be carbon neutral, I think by 2040, something like that. And that's primarily through buying carbon credits. And like Tesla is making a lot of money selling carbon credits. So there's a big industry here, and big name companies are lining up to participate, whether voluntarily or by you know, government mandates. Again, something we'll explore more in this episode, but very much looking forward to this. We're going to have on Luke Oliver. He's the managing director of Crane Shares. They have a suite of products and services, but the one we're going to be talking about specifically is the Crane Shares Global Carbon ETF, and the ticker is KRBN. And I can't wait to have on Luke and hear more.
You know what, Sam? I'm glad you brought up the idea of these companies going carbon neutral. That's something I want to bring up in the outro. And also, I have somewhat of a surprise announcement that has to do with this investment that I'll reveal after we talk to Luke as well.
Did you just buy a Tesla?
No, but I did buy something. So, okay. So let's talk to Luke. Sam's going to interview him, and we're going to learn all about this cap and trade in the carbon emissions market. This week's sponsor of Invest Like a Boss is Fundrise. Now, in 2021, a truly diversified portfolio needs to include private real estate. That's where Fundrise comes in. Fundrise provides access to diversified portfolios of private real estate to all investors, whether you're accredited or not, with their industry-leading, easy-to-use platform. Whether you're looking to add some stable cash flow via dividends or you prefer long-term growth, Fundrise makes it easy as investing in stocks, bonds, or mutual funds. Now, I personally use Fundrise as well. It's so easy. Every single week, I add to my account, and they send me updates about all these projects that they're in. Whether it's big or small, you get to find out about these deals, and it's really cool. It makes you feel a part of the process, yet you don't have to do any of the tough work. So it's like a win-win situation. So if you want to see for yourself how 150,000 investors have built a better portfolio with private real estate, it just takes a second to get started. Go to fundrise.com/likeaboss. That's fundrise.com/likeaboss. I'll spell it out for you. FUNDRISE.com/likeaboss.
All right. Luke Oliver, welcome to the show.
Hello, and thank you. Thanks for having me on.
We're looking forward to it. Carbon credits, this whole industry of emissions, it's starting to become something, I think for a good reason, it's starting to become on everybody's mind. And we sense that there's opportunity to also profit from it as investors. So we're delighted to have you on to kind of cover a new topic. 200 episodes in this podcast, it's not something we've really talked about specifically. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. And it's a new topic. It's relatively new in terms of financial markets. It's definitely a new and expanding asset class.
Absolutely. So I recently started hearing about carbon credits, but really just recently. I think NPR had done a couple of bits on it that they got pretty good circulation and reach. And then some big companies like Tesla, we start hearing kind of news about them and how they're making money with carbon credits. So I think it's peaked a lot of people's interest, but it's still somewhat vague, I think, to a lot of people in terms of how it works. I was hoping you could just give us kind of a light background on what you're seeing in the carbon credits industry and kind of the function of it.
Yeah, well, it is an entire industry, and with so many facets, so many players on so many different ends of the market, whether it be the companies that are making the emissions, the regulators that are creating the allowances, the firms that are creating offsets, which is a different market, and then all the market participants that create the liquidity and the price discovery in the middle. So there's a lot going on there. But at a very high level, and these markets are new, the European Union's ETS or emissions trading system didn't start until 2005, just to give you an idea of, you know, how new these markets are. And that's one of the oldest markets there is. So how these all generally work, and they're all a little bit different, but to keep it very high level, how these work is post-Paris Agreement, various regions, and these regions are growing, are creating, introducing these emission trading programs. And how the general way that they all work, as I said, they're all a little different, is they set a cap on the amount of carbon or carbon equivalents that can be released into the atmosphere in their region. So in the European Union, for example, they've set the cap at something like 1.6 billion tons of carbon dioxide or equivalent. I say equivalent because methane is another gas that is 25 times worse than carbon. So that's an equivalent, but in a different metric. But it's equivalent to individual tons of carbon dioxide. So they set a cap They auction allowances to allow people with those allowances to continue to emit that amount of carbon. So immediately that doesn't disrupt industry, doesn't disrupt markets, but it puts a price on carbon. And then what happens is once they've auctioned them, they can then be traded between various different companies. And what that means is that if you buy them and you're able to cut your emissions, you're able to sell those emissions for a profit. If you emit more than you need or more than you should, you have to buy more carbon credits. And that's where you can buy them on the secondary market. So what happens is this begins to benefit those that cut emissions and penalize those that do not cut emissions. What's more is that cap each year is reduced. So one way or another, this supply of these allowances and therefore emissions is going to fall, which is what we want. Mm-hmm. And almost as an indirect result, that's almost inevitable, the price of carbon credits has to go up as that supply goes down. Now, there are lots of things we can talk about that could affect the price up or down. There's risk in these markets. They're fairly volatile. But the overriding structure is that the supply will reduce year after year. The cap will come down. And therefore, the price will rise as we work towards a better world, essentially, reducing carbon emissions.
Fascinating. And I guess that's the term that is new to me. It's termed cap and trade. Is that correct?
Cap and trade, yes. And the reason I didn't use that phrase, and I called it ETS, Emissions mm-hmm. Trading System, is that cap and trade is what Europe, California, the northeast of the US, most of the programs use. China's program is slightly different and doesn't use a cap and trade. So you could say that, but just to be aware, there are some nuances that aren't technically cap and trade in different markets.
Got it. And I guess this whole thing came about on the heels of, or on the back of the Paris Agreement. And it was basically like, hey, we have a problem. How do we solve this problem? Well, the best way to solve it is to, this is the carrot and stick approach, right? Where like, we're going to put the cap in because we really have to stay under that, but we also need to have a profit element. And that's where the trade comes in.
Well, yeah, and this is what's great about this. The market has been introduced. The financial markets have come into play, which what the financial markets and the markets in general are good at is price discovery, allocation of resources, and risk management and risk transfer. And so what this allows is for the price to float, for the true price of carbon to be discovered, and it incentivizes the right behavior. So the example being, as this price of carbon rises, as the supply reduces, then companies can either choose to keep buying them, in which case they may become unprofitable, or they may pass that on to their customers, which may lose them customers as their prices increase, or they can find alternatives and they can find, you know, cheap alternatives, like maybe switching, or cheaper alternatives, like switching from coal to natural gas, which is an improvement and that can reduce their emissions. But then they start thinking about how can we create the technology that will capture carbon at the source, at the power plant? How can we invest more in renewable energy? How can we innovate to make green hydrogen a more realistic and more immediate source of energy? And so it incentivizes the cutting of emissions where they can be done easily, because it's why not when it's going to cost you money otherwise. So it's creating that capitalist thinking to solve the environmental problem. Secondly, it creates investment. Mm-hmm. Thirdly, it brings in entrepreneurs who now can see that their inventions, their innovations have a real value because you can say, I can cut you X million tons of emissions. Therefore, I can save you X hundreds of millions of dollars. And so immediately you bring in a lot more of the brain trust into solving these problems. And then the other one, the initial benefit is the auctions themselves raise money for these regulatory programs that then feed that money back in through grants, through policy, through investing in these initiatives to, for example, in Europe, a lot of money goes towards creating, you know, green public transport, for example. So it's bringing the market to bear to really have this, this powerful effect on reducing emissions. And what's great about that is we can participate in it, or institutions could participate in it. And what we've done with this fund is create something that everybody can invest in.
And which companies actually would need to apply with this standard? Is it all companies of the government or country that are opted into the Paris Agreement, or is it just large cap companies? How do
Yeah.
Like, surely it's got to be difficult to measure the carbon emissions of every company out there.
Yes. Yeah. So it varies by program by program. So in the northeast of the US, the program is called REGI, and that's all the states from Maine down to Virginia, across to Pennsylvania, which is in the process of joining. And we're seeing other states potentially joining as well, further south, North Carolina, for example. So in that program, it's only power generation. So power stations are the only entities that are participating. So that's a smaller program, but it's targeting the biggest or the worst culprit.
Got it.
When you go over to California or Europe, they are much broader. They're bringing in, you know, steel manufacturing, glass manufacturing, cement production. These are very high carbon emitting industries. So those come into play in a much broader catchment. And so for instance, in Europe, only about 40% of the emissions are covered by the program, which is pretty good. I think in California, it's even higher. It might be higher, closer to 80%. Hmm. However, to your second question, how they're measuring it, it's actually not that difficult. So yes, you're right. It's not, if you're driving a car to work in the morning, nobody's measuring how many tons of carbon that you're creating each year and trying to make you buy one of these allowances. But any company that has a sizable carbon footprint, and there's different thresholds for different programs, will fall into the catchment. And then they will be essentially audited and will have to produce the allowances alongside the amount of emissions that they are putting into the atmosphere. Mm.
Luke, I actually noticed this for the first time a few months ago. I booked a flight on Korean Air, and when I got the ticket in my email, it showed my per seat, per person carbon emission of that flight. And I thought that was really interesting that they're measuring that, but they're also bringing it to your eyes.
Yep.
And I feel like that's maybe a first step in them actually starting to potentially tax people on an individual basis. Like, you know, people that are jet setting all around the world and stuff are effectively no different than large companies that are the major offenders.
Potentially.
Yeah, it's a little off topic, but I thought that was interesting when I was thinking about this episode coming up.
Yeah, yes, yeah, so the same thing. My wife bought something on Etsy the other day, mm-hmm. and she goes, check this out. And it had at the bottom of the receipt, we are offsetting the cost of your purchase and the shipping by buying carbon offsets. And, right. and it's interesting because carbon offsets and carbon allowances are very different. And that's something that maybe I'll just spend 1 minute mm-hmm. explaining is carbon offsets are these programs. It's an incredibly small market, but it is getting a lot of press, and it's what people think of when they hear carbon offsets, carbon allowances also. So carbon offsets are, for example, somebody who buys a forestry and commits to not cut it down, or buys land and reforests that land. And then with the carbon that will potentially take out of the atmosphere, they then sell allowances to corporations who want to offset their carbon footprint. So that might be a company. So that might be someone like Etsy, that might be Korean Airlines, who are saying, we are emitting this much. We don't currently have a program, for example, that we have to buy allowances, but we want to offset by buying something that's carbon negative. So it's a little bit different. It's a voluntary market, and its supply is based on how many trees or forests you can purchase. And it's not just forests. You could invest in a wind turbine farm or something like that and create these offsets, but they're not mandatory. What we have in this fund and the markets that we watch are the mandatory compliance markets, where if you are in that territory, in that region, and you are emitting, you must buy these. And the reason I'd make that distinction is the price discovery is based on this scheduled decline in supply and the emitter's ability to reduce emissions and innovate over time. And that gives you, you know, a very tangible asset with very transparent demand and supply dynamics, which is quite different to a voluntary market, which potentially has unlimited supply and no one has to buy them. So just something to bear in mind, although those offsets are becoming increasingly popular. And my last 2 cents on that is I think both programs are very valuable. I prefer to innovate to reduce emissions rather than find ways to grow more trees to reduce your carbon footprint, because you're not really solving the problem.
It certainly seems like innovation would be the way to do it. And it would also have, I think, less integrity issues in the system. I feel like with these you know, these reforesting initiatives that are going on. They sound great on paper, but I have to imagine that there's just tons of corruption built into this, and who's actually going to own the land rights in 20 years, and are they just going to sell it to the next, to the highest bidder at that point? So
there's challenges for sure.
Seems the way, yeah.
Yeah, and I think about, if you think about, I mean, the offset markets have challenges, the challenges that you mentioned, but they're developing, they're becoming more regulated. There's a great future there. But to your point, I like to think about ESG. Everybody's talking about ESG and ESG investing. And it usually is how you score a company. How does it score in environment, social, and governance? You can't score carbon credits in that way because they don't have any of the characteristics of stocks. However, it's clearly environmental. If it's got a carbon footprint, carbon allowance has to be negative carbon because you're doing the opposite of emitting carbon. Social, I mean, it goes without saying, the purpose of these is to reduce emissions. Without reducing emissions, the social issues that we're going to have are going to be, you know, it's going to be a catastrophe. And then obviously governance, this is pure governance. These are run by governments to administer and manage emissions, right, in their regions. So it's almost like pure distilled ESG wrapped in an ETF. And that's what I think is so powerful about this.
And so it seems like there's somewhat of a predictable path for the increasing cost of carbon emissions over time. That's got to be a true statement, no?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's designed to, and it has to be much higher than it is today for it to work.
So really, innovation and carbon offsets seem to be what will make the increasing cost manageable for companies that are mandated by the state or country that they're operating in.
So the price must rise. Mm-hmm. The innovation that's required isn't happening at these prices. As the price rises, companies will see the benefit of spending $100 million on investing in this or funding research programs to find these solutions. And so the you could almost say, you know, if the innovation comes in, you know, overnight, then that would be great. You know, we're going to solve the climate crisis. Maybe not so good for carbon prices, but that isn't going to happen without the carbon price being much higher than it is, because unfortunately, the reality is that you need price discovery in order to have the right allocation of resources. The human race, I mean, we don't have to make this an environmental talk, but we're not going to make it if we don't solve this problem. And the reason we're in this problem is there's never been a price on carbon. You could produce anything you want and burn as much coal and create as much carbon dioxide as you want, and there's never been a price on that. And yet there's an incredible cost to doing that to the environment, and not just to trees and whales, to human health, human property, business. The Biden administration, and, you know, and we should note this is a bipartisan thing, it's the research on this, looking at what the damage to the environment, the current output of carbon dioxide creates. They back into what that price right now, for every ton of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere today, is costing $125 to the US economy. And that's through business disruption, you know, floods, lost business days due to hurricane, insurance costs going up, human health, sickness, wildfires, you name it. So at $125 a ton, even Europe, who people think have come a long way in this, they're only charging $60 a ton. We're nowhere near. In the northeast of the US, you can buy a power company in New York and pay under $9 for a ton. Hmm. And California is in the sort of $23 range. So there's still a long way to go. And that's why, A, we want this price much higher. B, it needs to be much higher for the reasons I mentioned. And C, you can go and invest in this fund at a blended price of about $35 a ton right now.
So I want to tie this, Luke, into actually a quote that's on your guys' website, and this might be a bit redundant, but just to make sure we drive the point home. So the quote on your website was, according to the IHS Markit, as of December 31st, 2020, the global price of carbon was roughly $24 a ton of CO2. It is estimated that carbon allowance prices need to reach a range of $50 to $100 to achieve the standards mandated by the Paris Agreement. And that difference, that $25 to $50 or above where we think it's going, that's the opportunity to profit through investment, correct?
This is from, the end of last year on based on, research, even prior to that for the range that because we're not there yet. And so these numbers, the bogey is getting further away. So right now the price is about $36 a ton, which is that blended global price that we create in the fund by bringing together the three major markets. And we will add more markets as they develop. The target price, I mentioned, the US administration puts it at $125. There is a consortium of asset owners that were convened by the UN who are putting this at $147. And they're looking for like a price channel in that region starting now. So these aren't forecasts. These are people saying this is what the price should be right now. So from a valuation perspective, that's where it's valued. Mm. And it's trading at 35. In the UK, they just created their own program as post-Brexit. The guidance that their companies, corporations in the US, UK are getting is you should be expecting over $100. So in short, it's trading at 35. The range is over $100. That is pretty consistent. Bloomberg puts it at $100 to hit the Paris Agreement targets by 2030. So the 50 to 100 is obsolete. It's 100 and 100 plus is wow. Where the majority. And just to put some context, there are people talking $300, $600, and where those and we don't talk about those because we like to, we kind of look at what's the next sort of price target. And that next price target comes from where can polluters switch to natural gas, to geothermal, whatever it may be, what can they switch to reasonably and get us on the road to reducing emissions and hitting those targets. But if you've got things like the magic bullet being green hydrogen, i.e. hydrogen that you can produce without a carbon footprint, because the problem with hydrogen is a very efficient fuel, but to create it, you need to use inefficient fuel. So we need to solve that problem. To solve that problem today, people are putting these $300, $600 price targets on carbon. But I think realistically, we need to be thinking 100 to 147, 150 is realistically where this has to get to in the next few years.
So at least 3x, but then?
Yeah. And for some of these markets, it'll be 10x.
So the CraneShares Global Carbon ETF, is that... So the actual underlying assets, are those stocks or some other form of assets?
Literally exposure to the carbon allowances. There's no stocks in this in this fund in terms of the exposure that we get. What we get is the carbon allowances are auctioned, and then those allowances can be traded between companies, but there's not a transparent liquid market on those. However, there is, like any good financial market, there's a futures contract on these, which allows companies to hedge their exposure, to transfer risk, and so on, just like in the commodity space. And so what we do is get long the futures on the European Union, the Californian, and the Northeast US ETS programs. So we are holding long positions in futures on carbon credits themselves. The carbon credits go up, the futures go up, the fund goes up.
I know you guys have had some phenomenal performance to date. We have a Patreon group, some of our very active listeners. And one of the Patreons, Evan Tavener, had a question. He says, in terms of KRBN, it seems too good to be true. The price of these carbon credits should continue to unquestionably rise in value. I'd like to know what are the major risks of the fund and whether other countries in the rest of the United States is looking into implementing carbon credits. Also, why has the price of carbon credits only recently started to rise a lot when they've been around for so long? P.S. I've recently opened a sizable position after hearing about the fund, and I'm very optimistic, but it's hard to find that much information on the topic.
So yes, well, thank you to Evan, and thank you for the investment. Mm-hmm. The first part was, the performance has been phenomenal, since inception, which we are 2 days past our 1 year anniversary, and the return has been about 83%. So significant performance in carbon credits over that period. In response to that, it sounds too good to be true. It's a phenomenal opportunity to buy something that is structured to go higher, i.e. they're reducing supply. The supply reduction is planned to be faster than even with great innovation, the demand in the change in demand. So it is structured to get higher. We need it to get higher. The plan is for it to get higher, and you can participate in investing in it. So that's a very unique opportunity. And it does sound almost too good to be true. So you have to think about what the risks are. It is a volatile asset class. Its volatility has been, significantly higher than stocks and bonds. That said, it's highly diversifying. So it's got a very low correlation to those things. So as part of a portfolio, it actually can reduce volatility at a portfolio level. So that's not necessarily a big risk, but something worth noting that it's more volatile than other asset classes. But the return expectations are there too. The other thing is, what happens, and I mentioned this earlier, what happens if someone solves this problem overnight and suddenly we don't have carbon emissions and all these credits aren't needed by companies anymore? Well, that's a risk. It's a good risk because it means our futures and our children's and grandchildren's futures are somewhat secured, mm-hmm. but it might not be good for the price of carbon. And while that is a risk, if you like, there's a small bet in here against the speed of human innovation. And I think we should never bet against human innovation. Why I think it's not a huge risk to this price of carbon is that even with great innovation, it's designed that the supply will fall faster. So it will maintain this rising price. And the price must get much higher in order to get the investment, to get the innovation. And so while it's a risk that innovation could be faster, I'd argue that that's not a bad thing at all. Secondly, it just isn't likely to happen. So people have said, the carbon capture technology might be 10 years away with investment when this thing's over, when this price is over $100 per ton. And so it's a risk, but I think it's a reasonably mitigated one that even as we get innovation and we hope the demand falls, the caps will be coming down. So emissions have to fall. Mm-hmm. The price should be maintained because the supply will be falling, quicker than demand can fall. So it's still, it's a strange dynamic that the market might get smaller in terms of units, but the value of that market will keep growing. And then the last thing, which I think is maybe just another one that has to be on the radar. And it's, again, I don't think it's that likely to happen, but could you have some huge political change that seeks to abolish these programs and do away with them? And it's just worth noting that these programs are relatively new. 2005 is when the EUAs came out. The California, the Northeast program is both Republican and Democrat states. So it's worth noting this is bipartisan. Even the US and China 100% agree on this topic. So I don't think that's a huge risk. And then I feel like there was another part to this question. Why have these allowances only started moving the last year or so?
Yeah, good memory.
And not going back to 2005. So there's a few things. I think two main things I'll highlight. One is the European program started in 2005. We then had the financial crisis 2008 through 2009. And what happened there was there was a huge glut. They wanted to be generous, so they didn't just, to start this program with a soft cap that was easily met. And then there was this huge recession, huge reduction in production, huge reduction in emissions, similar to what we saw at the early part of the COVID pandemic. And it meant there was a glut, and that glut meant that there was oversupply for several years. So if you look at a chart, a long dated chart on this, you'll see the price stayed really low for some time. And what Europe did was bring in a market stability reserve to eat up some of that excess supply and take that off the market permanently to get the market back on track. So that's happened. And so the supply dynamics are now finally kicking in. Secondly, California, having seen that, created a floor price so that the auctions wouldn't settle or clear unless that auction price was met. And so that solved that for California. So they kind of learned from Europe's mistakes in their program. So that's one reason why there was a slow start. The second reason, and this is something that I've just observed, is when these are trading low, then the power company, it's maybe an inconvenience. They'll just buy them. They're cheap. we'll buy them, we'll move on. It's only when they get into, and I think the number is somewhere in the sort of $20 to $30 range, where these companies say, okay, this is starting to pinch, it's starting to hit the bottom line. Let's buy some more of these. Let's buy these at auction. Let's make sure we're not being complacent. Let's make sure we're hedging our exposure to this. And the moment that light bulb goes off that these are important to the industries, that's when the price is really discovered, because up until that point, it was underpriced, and it hits that inflection point. So I think we saw that in Europe when these went from, you know, $30 to $60. In the US, Californias are in this $20 range, and low $20 to $25. I think we're hitting that tipping point in California where they suddenly get to their real true price discovery. And then the Northeast US isn't there yet, and they're growing steadily. But I think they steadily grow until the industries realize we need them. And then they jump. And where they jump to is the price of the next cheapest alternative.
Right.
So in Europe, we're in this range now. We kind of slowed a little bit into this range. We're kind of consolidating around this $60. And the reason for that is at this price, it's cheaper to switch to natural gas. And so we're seeing lots of power generation and fuel being switched in Europe to natural gas. So for a little while, we'll be in a range with the natural gas prices. Natural gas gets more expensive, carbon gets more expensive. Natural gas gets cheaper, carbon gets cheaper. But at some point, all the switches to natural gas that can be made will be made, or the price of natural gas will just get higher because of the new demand for it. And you'll see carbon then be released. No pun intended. The price of carbon will be released. It's really hard to talk about this without puns, without, you know, whether it's talking about things being on fire or
right.
There's a lot of them that come out by accident, but then that's what happens. So the price can really leg up to that next cheapest technology, and I think that's where we are now.
There are some really interesting economic dynamics at play with this whole thing that I'm sure you have a lot of fun thinking through the puzzles of on a regular basis. But besides just the profit narrative of the ETF, Luke, who might this kind of global carbon ETF be right for? What type of investors?
Well, it's a great diversifier. So we're seeing investors of all stripes, institutions, retail, buying this as an alternative. So it has a fairly independent return. It has that great potential that we've talked about, and it also diversifies and can reduce the overall volatility of your portfolio. So it really does all of those things. But if you're an ESG investor, like I mentioned, this is, to me, is almost like a distilled ESG exposure. If you are long, I mean, a great example of something that we've seen people do is they're ESG investors, and they're investing in companies that they think will win in the, you know, decarbonization, create these technologies. So they're still including power companies or oil companies. And it's interesting. It seems like a little bit of an oxymoron, but to have an oil company in an ESG portfolio can make sense, because those oil companies are some of the biggest investors in green energy. So we're seeing people who care about ESG, but they're holding oil companies. And so what we say to them, and we've seen lots of people do this, is by buying something like KRBN, you're able to be long that energy company you think is going to do well, but that energy company 100% will be exposed to the price of carbon. So you want to be hedged using KRBN. And so KRBN almost acts as a hedge against any company that is emitting, because those companies will have to bear the rising cost of carbon. So I think in a world where more and more regions, more and more industries are going to be covered by carbon credits, you need to own it to take that portion of the risk off the market. And so either use it to take that out of your portfolio, take that risk out of your portfolio to some degree, or at least help mitigate it. Mm-hmm. You should also be thinking about, do you want to just be outright long this exposure? And I think the answer for the diversification and the return benefits, the potential, is a yes. So certainly how I use it is to hedge that exposure and to be exposed to this, which is something I think is so important that it rises in value. And the way the market is structured, it should over time rise in value and potentially by a great deal.
So from an environmentalist standpoint, or someone that's very pro-earth or green conscious, this being long on the rising price of, or betting long on the rising price of carbon emissions, this is sort of a kind of a green play in a sense, is it not?
Absolutely. Yeah. And if by participating in these markets, we're creating liquidity, risk transfer, and price discovery, we're helping this industry, we're helping this price of carbon, and we're potentially having, direct impact.
I love it. Love that narrative. Luke, before closing, I just wanted to see if you could share a little bit more about Crane Shares and some of the products and services that you guys have that our listeners might be interested in beyond just this global carbon ETF.
Yeah. Well, so Crane Shares, highly innovative asset manager, global asset manager. Its roots are in exchange traded funds and recognizing these great opportunities for investors. So a lot of the focus of the fund was in, or is in, China, and the fact that China is this huge growing market, largely untapped, the mainland, by US and international investors. In fact, one of the lowest foreign ownership stats in China versus the rest of the world. So really, opening up those opportunities as China continues to become more investable. And as well as we have a second platform that brings, highly innovative first-to-market solutions. We have a great inflation product, IVOL. I mentioned we have a managed futures product, KMLM. KRBN sits right between the two because, of course, emissions will be very much a China story as the largest emitter, but also just this innovation access that this hasn't been done before. This is the very first carbon ETF on the market, and it offers all three of those markets. And of course, in the China space, probably the most topical two tickers. One is KBA, which is our core China mainland equity ETF. KBA gives you that exposure to all of these companies in mainland China that just has this huge growing audience in China and is opened up to international investors, and is just an incredible opportunity to participate in the growth of the middle class and the economic development of China, which is one of the main drivers of global growth. And then the other one is KWEB, KWEB, that gives exposure to Chinese internet names and Chinese tech names. And right now, depending on when you're listening to this podcast, we've just gone through a huge correction in pricing that many think has been oversold due to some sort of heavy-handed regulation on just a handful of companies, and it's affected the price of the whole basket. So we're seeing lots of people take the opportunity to get long China tech at the moment in this at the lows of KWEB right now. So it's become a very topical fund. So I'll leave you there. There's lots of interesting things going on, and what we're about is innovation and access to these really unique opportunities.
Great. And Luke, are there any minimums to your funds, and or can you give us an idea of the management fees?
Management fees range, KRBN is at 89 basis points. KWEB is at, let me just pull it up here, is at 73 basis points. So we're in that range. We're sort of in the 69 to 99 basis points for that inflation fund. But for something like KRBN, where there's nothing on the market, these are all priced very competitively for the unique exposures that they bring. And there's no minimums. I mean, the minimum is one share, and these trade between, KRBN's at $35, KWEB's at $49. So these are all low increment funds that you can buy as much or as little of as you'd like.
Great. Luke, man, this has been a lot of fun. Looking forward to publishing this episode. Cleared up a lot of questions I know that a lot of us had just regarding carbon credits, carbon emissions, and kind of where the industry is going. And appreciate you sharing more about the products and services you guys have at Crane Shares. We'll be sure to check it out and leave links to everything in the show notes. But have a great rest of the morning, and thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Sam. Talk to you soon.
Sam, amazing interview. I am super excited for this whole thing. I had no idea how any of this worked, and I feel like I have such a better picture now after talking with Luke.
I feel a little bit better about the world and humanity, knowing that I didn't really know about these programs, to be honest. I didn't know about cap and trade. I knew the world was kind of, I didn't really know what the Paris Agreement was. I still don't know everything in it, but it seems like
there's a lot of initiative based around getting this under control. Like, the problem's been identified. There's almost global support around solving the problem, but it's not like crisis mode yet, right? I know a lot of scientists would say it's crisis mode, but for the mainstream, the people that are still driving their trucks, their gas trucks, and working on the oil rigs and everything else, like, no one's really in crisis mode, right? But it seems like this is a really smart program that is a mix of, you know, it's a mix of carrot and the stick. It's a mix of government mandates and capitalism. And I think it's going to work. Like, it seems to be working already. What I don't know yet, and you might, Derek, is like, what, for this to be really effective, like, basically every country, state, province needs to adopt it, right? What happens if they don't? Like, can Russia just not participate in this forever? Because obviously it puts pressure on corporations.
So I don't think they can force any country to do it. And the way I could see this happening is, you know, something like this fund or any of these other kind of similar investments, they see that there's an opportunity to make money. So it's almost, you could essentially pressure a government to implement a program like this because it's going to be good for profit. So it sounds awful, I think, you know, to say, you know, we have to do this just to make money. But at the same time, it's also environmentally conscious, where you're doing two good things. You're helping the environment, you're reducing carbon, and there's also a chance for profit there. And you know how that works. Once it works in one place and someone made some money, they're going to do everything they can to get it in a new place.
Right.
So let's talk about the markets that KRBN focuses on right now. So he mentioned the EU's program. And then we also have California, which is kind of, you know, been one of the first places to really do it anywhere, especially in the United States. And then there's this program called REGGI, which is RGGI. That's the Northeast US program. I think it's like 11 states. And I just saw that Washington state just passed a carbon allowance program as well. So I think we're up to like 12 states here in the US, which is pretty good progress. It seems like the coast, it seems like everything, you know, the coast kind of take it on first, and then it's going to kind of infiltrate the rest of the country.
So basically, on a state level, this gets passed by state, by Congress or state Senate, I forget who passes, probably both. But then the people ultimately vote in Congress and Senate. And I think in some cases, these type of things are even voted on by the people, like directly by the people versus voted on by Congress and Senate. But like, why would the people? Okay, so if you enforce this on a state level on your corporations, the price to the consumer is going to go up, at least in the short term, for all their products and services, I would believe. So why would the people of a state like California vote to do this? And I'm guessing it's because both environmental reasons, but also it's a cleaner place to live, right? If you're living in a state and the carbon emissions are much lower, you know, your air quality is better, your food quality is better, the water quality is better.
Yeah,
so I'm guessing that's why this is happening.
So this is passed quite a while ago. I don't know the exact date. I want to say the early 2000s, like 2006. AB 32 in California. If you live in California like I do, you realize you vote on everything, which is cool, but it can be a little overwhelming. And there's really aggressive marketing campaigns on all these bills too. So, you know, I don't know how it was pitched in 2006. It was before my time, but it was a lot of times, you know, they can spin it certain ways, however you want to do it. And it's essentially whoever has, you know, more money to fund the right outcome. Or it can be worded really strangely too, where you think you're voting yes on something, but it's really a no. So California is kind of a weird example where it's really confusing. But overall, I would say, you know, it's about the environment. And California, I've noticed, even if the taxes go up, no one cares. They just, in their head, it's the right thing to do and they want to pay it. And it's essentially why we have some of the highest taxes in the United States.
Yeah. Well, there's like 5,000 people from California moving to Texas every day. So at least that many people care.
That's fine. Free up a house for me because there's still none left.
Derek's going to look at a bargain in Malibu after this, actually.
We'll see. It could be one of these too good to be true situations, but Malibu Beach sounds pretty good right now.
So I actually heard in California, sort of related, that they recently passed a bill that is mandating that pig farms have to have like certain conditions and space for each pig. And if they don't comply, then they can't sell pork to California. And supposedly it got voted in with like overwhelming support, like more than 85%. And it's supposed to be in force starting in like 6 weeks. And they said that only 4% of the pig farms in the USA are compliant right now. And if it goes in 6 weeks, you know, this got passed a while ago, but like it's actually going to be enforced in 6 weeks. If it becomes enforced, there will basically be no pork available in California starting whenever this enforcement is. So now I guess they're like talking about trying to figure out a way to extend it or loosen it up, because they're like, well, what happens if no one can have bacon? You know, is everyone going to be like, all right, forget it. Like we revert our vote.
But you know what? That brings a really good point to what Luke was talking about. He had brought up the scenarios on where, you know, the price of the carbon might go down or just may not even need these carbon credit programs anymore because of innovation. So I think government just gets in its own way sometimes. So, you know, it's great that, you know, the pigs have more space and they're not living on top of each other. But someone didn't have the hindsight to think, oh, these farmers can just turn this around in 6 weeks and no problem. That's government thinking right there, where it's not thinking. So no one's ever on the same page. So if your bet is that, you know, these carbon credit programs won't be around in a couple of years because we'll figure out a solution, I don't see that happening at all, because the government will do something to just get in the way, and it's going to take 2-3 times as long as it should. Even if we find a solution, just implementing that with all government regulation, especially in the United States, and I'm sure the EU is the same way, it's just not going to happen.
You know what I'm thinking immediately is that if California has a pork shortage, it's going to be really good business for Very Good Food Company and
yeah,
Beyond
exactly.
Meat and Impossible Burger. So maybe we need to keep an eye on that. I'm sure like if you were a private equity company or like you'd be kind of eyeballing that as an opportunity, you know.
So if you
California
don't remember,
has no access to pork in 6 weeks.
Oh, so
what
we got to
are going to profit.
We got to eat beans. That's what right. That's the main ingredient from Very Good Food Company. If you guys don't remember that episode, that was, what did we talk about? That episode 181, and that's an investment that actually Sam and myself both made. And as of right now, it's
long,
not doing
long.
So well. So we could really
it's
use
like
the
4 weeks. See, this is the short, the day trader side of Derek talking, where I'm like, you know what? This is a 10-year play. Just like KRBN is a 10-year play. Like you mentioned innovation. So there's only two risks that I've identified with this fund. One is, and we talked about in the episode, one is instant innovation, where overnight there's a new energy source technology that can be rolled out and distributed across all the markets that, you know, that KRBN is trying to profit in. And then it's basically irrelevant, an irrelevant ETF at that point. Mm-hmm. Or the political change, right? Where all of a sudden states are like, all right, our corporations can't stay competitive and we need to pull out of that. And I don't think, you know, I think those are very manageable risks. The innovation is just, it's not going to happen on that time scale unless we get to some serious, serious crisis where like all the governments in the world are like, all right, strict mandates on this stuff. You know, the world's on fire. And then you would see this massive, massive push on the innovation side. But it's not going to happen. And I tend to believe that a lot of the companies that are innovating in the space, there's some good players. I think like Tesla and a bunch of small companies that are really trying to force change. But there's also on the negative other side, right? There's these companies that profit basically from carbon emissions. And, you know, they're probably eyeballing a lot of the innovation, but they're either slowly bringing it into market or they're putting up barriers to enter the market.
Right. And as far as the political change, I don't see that being an issue either. Luke had said even this Reggie deal that's going on in the Northeast U.S., It's going to be about to be 11 states, I think, and it's a bipartisan program. So Republicans and Democrats are on it. And all this stuff existed while Trump was president, who's, you know, essentially the polar opposite of Joe Biden. So even in some wild scenario where Trump is president again, I don't see any of this stuff rolling back. And I don't see anyone more, you know, kind of polar extreme jumping in office than, you know.
He pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. So I thought that that would have implications on this whole thing, but I guess it didn't.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, we still have our own programs, even if it's not aligned with the Paris Agreement.
Yeah.
You know, there's still enough people out there to say, you know, this is something that we need to do.
Maybe it's just on a state level instead of being a federal mandate instead.
Sure. Which is kind of, you know, the whole Republicans ideal is leave it to the states. So,
right.
You know, we're only at 11 states, but, you know, hopefully that keeps growing. I want to bring up the carbon neutral ideas that you had talked about, you know, like Microsoft or any of the other companies advertising that they're carbon neutral or will be carbon neutral. I've even seen one saying carbon negative. So how much of this do you really think is we're doing the right thing versus it's good PR?
I think a lot of it is good PR, but I also think that a lot of these, you know, these people that are stepping up and saying this, like Bezos and Gates, and they've profited so much off the free market and, you know, more or less like pillaging the earth for so long that I think you get to this point where, you know, your focus shifts to how can you make real good meaning out of the last 20 years of your life. And I think a lot of them are trying to figure out what that narrative is. Obviously, you know, Gates is trying to do what he can. Bezos just went to the edge of space and created quite a bit of pollution in doing so. But now he's like, you know, this all inspired guy to become like this green entrepreneur in the next 20 years and space entrepreneur. So I think there's absolutely good intention. And I think a lot of these big companies see the tide starting to shift. And you're not going to be able to resist it for too long. You might as well go ahead and be on the front of that wave instead of being dragged behind by it. So I think this is great. You know, my position was I've traditionally been a Republican, but I was always pro Earth. I was always pro planet because, like, look, you know, you can believe in climate change or not. I tend to, but either way, why does it not make sense? Go ahead.
It's sad that this is considered a political issue, though, because it shouldn't be a political issue, whether, you know, no matter what side you're on, you know, you should want to leave the planet a better place.
Exactly. You should want to leave the planet a better place. And it makes me so ill when you talk to someone, they're like, oh, I don't care, I'll be dead by then. Like, it's just so such like an ignorant, like shitty thing to say. Right.
I whatever. Totally agree with that.
I get so pissed when I hear people say that. And you hear it, people say it all the time.
Yeah,
tons
it sucks.
Of friends that say it. It makes me ill. But look, we should leave it a better place, but we also want to live in a better place. Like cleaner air, better water, more wildlife, more national parks, quieter roads, quieter places. Like, this is a beautiful, beautiful place to live, but we are destroying it. And, we got to get started now. We got to get started now. We're starting to see these things, like after the very good food episode, and we did a lot of research on meat replacements and basically, the terminology is so like goofy, but let's just say meat.
Yeah, everyone uses different terms.
Protein replacements.
So one thing kind of related to that, I didn't realize that they don't just charge for carbon. They also charge for methane, which is, you know, the number one gas given off by cows, speaking of the meat industry. And the methane is like 25 times worse emissions than one ton of methane is 25 times worse than one ton of carbon. I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
It's really weird how no one's talking about that. You guys can all watch the documentary Cowspiracy. There's also Seaspiracy. They're really good documentaries, but it is very strange how no one's talking about that. But I for those reasons, I think that and beyond just slaughtering animals for protein, like I think we got to get really working on this stuff. But the good thing is like through all the research of that episode, I was just like blown away about how many companies are working on it. And there's profit to be made, but there's also the feel good narrative. So Yeah. And it's the same with this. Like it's very cool to find an investment opportunity that you can feel really good about. I think this is, you know, for all the reasons that was said on the episode and explored on the episode, I think this is a great investment. Spoiler alert. I've just made an investment in it. It took me about a day to get into it. There's not a ton of liquidity, but I took out a sizable position in it. And I'm going to hold it long. I think it's a great investment opportunity. And it's one of those feel good investments as well. You know, want to get on board with this stuff. So it's the first step.
Well, guess what, Sam? You and I are simpatico because literally 10 minutes before we got on this call, I put an order to buy some KRBN as well.
All right. Brothers of brothers in arms.
Usually I feel like the guinea pig recently because you and Johnny are a little burnt out on, you know, buying into everything we talk about. But this one, it wasn't even like a guinea pig situation. I was like, I should definitely get into this. And you know what? A little bit of my conscience snuck in too, because looking at some of the holdings I have, you know, I have a lot of energy companies, a lot
tobacco,
of utilities.
Oil.
And I'm like, these companies put out a lot of pollution. So maybe I should offset my karma a little bit.
That's right. Yeah. Your investment karma. Okay. Good for you. I'm glad to see you're finally growing a conscious 190 episodes in.
A little bit. Don't get too crazy.
Well, it was only two clicks in my E-Trade account. So it wasn't like opening a new account, which I'm definitely trying to stay away from. But yeah, it was super easy to get into it. And Derek, just don't come on the episode in 3 weeks and be crying if it's down 5%.
Okay? I'm still holding very good food.
Long term.
I'm in it.
Okay. 5 years. Give it 5 years.
Once again, it's one of these investments I wish we knew about a year ago. They've done over 80. They've been, as of recording this, like 1 year and like 4 days, and it's gone up over 80%. But I don't see this going down, or I don't know if it'll do 80%. You know, I'd love if it did. But this is really similar to like we had some like the farmland episodes on recently too. It's, you know, it's a shrinking supply and it's a greater demand because these companies need these and the government is putting out less and less every year. So it just makes sense that the price is going up.
Yeah. Now, every time that there's a unfortunate raging fire across this great state of California, you can have a little bit of a silver lining knowing that the world's paying attention and it's probably going to cost carbon emissions to go up a little bit.
Exactly. So one thing I want to talk about before we get out of here too, Luke brought up the difference between carbon offsets and carbon allowances. Now, KRBN invests in carbon allowances. A carbon offset, which I was kind of wondering, I'm like, there's got to be some way for companies to get out of this. So carbon offset is, let's say you buy a piece of land and you put crops on it, or you forest it, and then they can measure that, you know, whatever species of tree or crop it might be, this will erase so many tons of carbon per year. So these companies can actually buy into land like that. So I was like, so what's to stop a company just from buying up a bunch of land and going, hey, we're good for 20 years. Look at all the land we bought to offset mm-hmm. our factories or whatever it may be. So at least in California, I looked up their program. When it first started, you could only do 8% of your carbon credits as an offset. So you couldn't just buy a ton of land and go, we're good forever. And now it's actually been reduced to 4%. So it's pushing these companies that they have to, 96% of their carbon credits that they're using have to be allowances in these auctions that we're talking about. So there's really not much of a way around it. You know, 4% of it is kind of a loophole, I guess.
Smart. Because that was what I was understanding, like Microsoft was doing. They're just like, you know what? We're just going to keep doing business as usual and we'll just roll over some of our billions in profits and just buy these offsets and call it a day.
Yeah, but in reality, it's a really small piece of the puzzle. So I'm actually really glad to hear that. And it just makes our case better that, you know, these carbon allowances are just going to keep raising in price.
Right. Great. Great little bit of research there, Derek. That's why we pay you the big bucks.
The huge bucks.
That's why we fly you economy to Kiev. All 6'4" of you.
Ooh, I don't think you saw Sam on the way home. So advantage to flying coach for once. So you know how they put the curtains up in the plane?
Uh-huh.
It was like, I was so deep, I was two curtains in. And, but you know what? There's about 20 rows of seats, 4 people in that entire section of the plane.
Wow. Unbelievable.
I had an entire row to lay flat. I had poor man's first class the whole flight.
Just as good as business class. Just as good as business class.
I'm sure you guys planned it that way, though.
Right. Yeah. Good. All right. Well, shout out to Luke for coming on this episode, and shout out to our Patreons for all the support, and also for the ones that joined us out in Kiev for the meetup. If you guys missed it, be looking forward to lots of other ones. We got a lot of good ones planned, and this has always been kind of the premise of Invest Like a Boss. We want to get together at least once a quarter in a cool place in this world and check out investing opportunities. Of course, hang out, have some refreshments, and talk about investing strategies. But it's also about looking for cool investments in different places of the world. And if you guys enjoyed this episode, do us a favor, leave us a review. They've been helping out a lot, and they really help us to attract better and better guests to bring on each and every week now. And also, if you find anyone that might be interested in this episode, shoot them a link to it. That also helps spread the word, and we'll get the message out more about this great initiative that's going on.
Yeah, we also got a cool new feature coming up called Boss Insider. So if you're a Patreon member, even as low as the $5 a month member, we're going to give you guys like unprecedented access to CEOs and major bosses that we've had on in the past. So if there's an episode that you heard about and you're like, I'm kind of on the fence about that because, you know, I want to ask this or that question, you can literally be on a Zoom call with these executives that we've had on and ask them yourself. So I don't know where else you're going to be able to actually get that. Even, you know, any of these big investments, you can reach out and you know, talk to a rep or whoever it may be, but you're not talking to the big boss in the corner office. That's who we're going to have on. And you can talk to them directly, ask them anything you want to know. And there's also going to be other bosses in there asking questions that maybe you didn't even think of too. So we want to give you guys confidence to invest in something, or you know what, if it's a bad investment and you come to the conclusion of that, you know, you might've dodged a bullet, whatever it may be. We want you to have all the knowledge you can to invest wisely. And this program is going to be awesome. So once a month through the end of the year, we're going to have like some awesome guests coming up. The first one is scheduled for September 9th right now. So it'll be about 2 weeks from this episode airing. Just nice. Sign up, investlikeaboss.com, click on become a Patreon. Any level member will get access to these calls.
I'm super pumped up for Boss Insider. Actually, this was an idea of Derek's recently. So great idea, Derek. And looking forward to re-engaging with all of these great guests that we've had on the episode in the past and bring them on for this almost night of a round table. We're going to be sitting around. They're going to be doing short presentation, doing Q&A, and we're all just going to be hanging out, talking about the investment opportunities and Q&A. So it's going to be a lot to learn, but it's also going to be a great little community. I'm personally looking forward to it. And make sure you guys join for the first one. When was it, Derek? September 4th?
September 9th will be the first one. We're having Mike Vrankovich. He is the managing director of Empire Flippers Capital. You guys awesome. Are really excited about that new fund that they have. And he's got some brand new ones he's going to debut just for us.
Lovely. Grant, can't wait, man. Great. Awesome episode. Thank you, Derek. Appreciate it. And thank you to all of our listeners. You guys have a great week, and we will see you and catch you and listen to you, or you listen to us next week.
Stop talking, Sam. You're burning more carbon. See you guys.
Thanks for listening to the Invest Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.